Welcome to The Intentional Investor with Matt Ziegler, where he and his guests explore the intersection of investing and life, portfolio and purpose. Nothing in this podcast is investment advice. Nothing in this podcast is advising you to buy or sell any security or to do anything with your money. Seriously, you should only act on investment advice from someone you know and who knows your unique situation. We are not that person. Matt Ziegler is a managing director at SunPoint Investments, and the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the opinions of SunPoint Investments or of Second Foundation Partners. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of SunPoint Investments.
Hello and welcome. This is another episode of The Intentional Investor on the Epsilon Theory YouTube channel. Make sure you subscribe if you haven't already. We're talking about where purpose meets portfolio. And today, I'm your host, Matt Ziegler, with an extra special guest. I've referred to him previously as the Polish Batman. You might know him for his podcast, Talking Billions. Highly recommend. Like and subscribe to that one too. Or maybe it's for one of his, yes, we do have, ladies and gentlemen, we have plural books by this man on investing and having an infinite time horizon, especially in periods where we feel our very finite humanness. You might even know him from the TEDx stage or a value investor hangout, like that party in Omaha that Warren likes to throw. But my guest today, founder of Blue Infinitas Capital, ladies and gentlemen, yes, the Polish Batman himself, now revealed, Mr. Bogomil Baranowski. Say hello, sir.
Well, hello, everyone. And Matt, it's the highlight of my week. I was looking forward to this conversation. And the funny thing happens that even before we started recording, you and I were just going on and on. And I just said, let's start recording this because I think there's no shortage of topics you and I can talk about. And I'm always amazed with the speed of your mind. And it's not just the speed, but also the reach and the depth and your memory too. Like you'll never forget an idea that really made an impression on you. And then you bring it back and you tie it to another thing and another thing. And it's just, I think it's amazing. So it's a gift and it's a blessing. And I'm glad you're doing this and sharing it with the world.
Well, it's a gift that I will share with you and for everybody else in my life who has suffered my severe ADHD that's been underdiagnosed for years. Maybe YouTube is the answer ultimately. So this is going to be a sprawling conversation. If you didn't catch the one with, by the time this one comes out, the Ben Hunt episode is out. You'll definitely want to check that out. Justin Castelli, wonderful episode with him is already out. Bogomil, I want to start you with this. I want to start with talking about trees. We've talked about this publicly before, but I want to talk about trees. I want to talk about planting trees, enjoying their shade, turning them into books. I'll leave the desks aside this time. But take me back. Let's start here. You got a story about a tree, somebody important in your family planted. And I know there's an investment metaphor inside of this here somewhere, but tell me about a tree that someone in your life planted that meant something to you. What's the story?
There's a tree in a town where my grandparents used to live. My grandma is still around. And it's a tree planted in a park. And it was the year 1917, 1918, the end of World War I. And Poland was about to regain independence. Poland lost independence in 1795 and was not around on the map for 125 years. But the culture, the language, the people continued and kept it alive, which is very impressive, I think. Very unique in the history on a very complicated continent. But my great-grandfather must have been a teenager at the time, and he planted an oak tree with his colleagues from high school. And there's a little plaque next to it, and it's a tree next to which I walked many times as a kid. And I learned to ride a bicycle and on those little paths. And my dad, my grandparents walked under that tree. And every time I visit, I make an extra effort to walk to that end of the park and stand under that tree. And it's a very powerful metaphor to me personally, because I devoted my life to managing money for wealthy individuals, families with multi-generational wealth. And I think of their wealth like a tree that got planted by somebody. And there's a saying and there's a quote, I'm forgetting who said it, but I brought it up a couple of times, how this idea of planting trees for others to enjoy. There's something about creating something that you might not get to see, and but you know others will. And there's this connection between generations that appears, and it's very powerful. And it's not just financially speaking, the capital that was started by one family member and goes on and on. I was speaking earlier today with somebody who shared a family story with me off the record, but it rhymes with so many other stories of a family member that created wealth that's serving yet another generation and what kind of responsibility and respect comes with it. But that tree is a reminder for me of something that physically connects me with a family member that I never got to meet. He passed away a year or two before I was born, my great-grandfather. But the tree and the shade and what it meant, it's still around and it's a connection. It's a lesson in patience and it's a lesson in appreciation of the sort of bridge that exists among generations. And it's in family stories, it's in all kinds of legacies that reach far beyond just financial wealth. But that's the story of that particular tree.
Well, speaking of bridges across time,
yeah.
What about books? So you take a tree, you cut it down, you chop it up into pulp, and now you can print stuff on it.
Uh-huh.
You found a very important book at one point in time in an English bookstore in a far, far away land, at least to me in Pennsylvania here. Well, tell me the story about finding that book.
Books have a power to change our lives. And I think you and I spoke about an old book before we started recording. Maybe it will come up in the conversation. But that particular book was very meaningful to me. I was a student, exchange student in Brussels at the time. So I started school in Poland, went to university there. And I was very eager to see more of the world. And I thought being an exchange student sounded really exciting. And it really was. I met kids from all over. And I realized that we're more alike than we think. And in the ways that we're different makes the conversation more exciting. You know, Italians cooking at night, different food, and the Spaniards and so on. It made me appreciate the variety of the world that's there to find. And I was taking courses in business and finance, economics, political science. I wanted to make sense of the world, maybe because I grew up in Poland that went through massive changes. I was growing up from a communist country without a free market economy to a booming economy with a hyperinflation, huge unemployment, or a stock market reopening. I just wanted to make sense of what is it that happened and why it's had such a huge impact on people's lives. And the opportunities that were created, money that was made and the money that was lost, I think was just mind-boggling for me. And in all those fields, I was looking for the answer, but I didn't have an understanding of how I can take that kind of curiosity and deploy it in one single direction. I didn't know. And becoming an accountant, I felt like that's limiting. And I thought about it, getting involved more in politics, and I volunteered and I worked with a few politicians in Poland at some point in my previous life. So that part appealed to me, but I thought I don't want to commit my whole life to that. Picking up that one book, One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch in that little bookstore in Brussels one Friday evening, completely changed my life. And there were so many ideas in that book. And the biggest one that I keep repeating is that stocks are small pieces of businesses. I was taking really advanced courses in options pricing with Greek letters and all kinds of theories. But nobody sat down with me and said, listen, it doesn't matter if you have $100 in your pocket or if you have billions, you get to own small pieces of businesses that happen to be traded on the stock market. That's all there is to it. And Peter Lynch goes as far as telling us that we all have already the secret advantage of understanding so many businesses because we use their services and goods in our everyday life. And I thought about it and I looked at everything around me in a different way, thinking always, is this a publicly traded company that's making this beverage that I'm enjoying this afternoon? And if so, how big is it? Who else is buying this product? How much are they making per unit? And on, it opened my eyes and what kind of, political context there is to it. How come they're doing business in countries that seem to be very hard to get into and ship from and ship to? And it just was touching on all the fields that I was fascinated with, economics, business, political science, and geopolitics. How does this whole thing work? You have this massive corporation managed out of somewhere in the middle of the US or Europe or Asia, shipping products around the world, collecting profits, and somehow making it all work and making a profit at the end. And you as a shareholder, no matter how small you are, you could benefit from the success of that business. I never looked back.
Is there a connection? I've wanted to ask you this before, because you lived in Poland at a period of time when Poland was really cut off from the rest of the world. Is that, that fair to say?
Fair to say.
And in this period, and focus on this first, just first, this is kind of a two-parter question, I guess. You experienced, how much of your life did you experience basically inside of a country that had elected to wall itself off from everything else? How long did you live that?
10 years, a quarter of my life.
And how old are you? This is like the first 10 years of your life, or this is?
First 10. So I was born in 1980, and Poland really opened up in 1989, 1990. So the first decade was in a different universe. Completely different planet almost.
And your experience inside of this, so like the first 10 years, because it's the first 10 years, you don't have an idea that anything else is different.
Yeah.
Tell me the story. Tell about your grandmother for a second, or your grandfather, whoever would, you had these ration tickets or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Am I remembering this? You've told me this before. Tell that story for just a second, because I love this. You're in a fishbowl as a kid. Like, you don't know, like, stocks don't exist as a thing yet to you.
No.
You're in this fishbowl first, deeply understanding that the way you think your little 8-year-old life is going is the way every 8-year-old in the world lives. Just retell that story for us.
It was a peculiar time, and I think it took me years to understand the reality that was around me. And I'll come back to it in a minute, because I'm thinking of people that grow up with massive inheritances, you know, big massive inheritance. And we all grow up in a certain fishbowl. And we think that the whole world is the same. There's a beautiful dissertation book by Johnny Bruntman that wrote a book about the inheritance experience that I'm sure you know. And there's one chapter that talks about the psychology of money. And she has quotes from people that grew up with big affluence in the household. And they fought. They honestly fought as children, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's just human experience that the whole world lives exactly the way they do. They have staff in the house helping. They have summer trips and flights into different directions and so on, and all the luxuries. That was normal. And that's what they fought. That's normal to everybody. Me growing up in Poland in the 1980s, really rhymes with that, because I thought that the whole world works exactly the same way my 7-year-old, 8-year-old world was working. And I think it's just very, very human that we assume all of us are living through the same experience. My particular experience, looking back, the more I say it, the more I share it with you or with the audience, the more bizarre it sounds, and funny and amusing and strange at times. So Poland is actually a relatively rich country, and was invaded by all the neighbors, mostly because it was a relatively rich country with a lot of great land to grow all kinds of grains, and not only, and then big meat production. And the mismanagement of the economy in the 80s, the very oppressive policies at the same time, led to massive shortages. I think it's very hard for people to imagine that there was no free market or private ownership of things. So you couldn't own a business. You could get a license to have a tiny little flower shop or a fruit stand, but that was very, very minimal. And any other activity, business activity, production, everything, sales, was owned and controlled by the government, allegedly by all of us, because communism says that we all own it, which means that nobody owns it. And a small group of people have a very convenient influence on the universe. But it led to such massive shortages that the government had to put in place ration cards. They're different than food stamps. Food stamps are meant for people with low income. Different intention, different approach. But ration cards were used in the past in different parts of the world. I was just speaking with somebody in the UK, how in the 1950s, still after World War II, they had ration cards because the economy could not keep up after such a huge destruction of the war to produce enough so that you could have enough in the stores. And in the 80s, that's what was created in Poland, you know, huge shortages to the point that you had the cash, you had the job, you had the money. You would go to the store with the ration card and they would still not have it, what it says on the ration card. And when I say it, its basic goods, you know, flour, sugar, and meat, chocolate. If you had kids, you could take more milk. So basic products. I'm not talking about anything sophisticated. In the country that is surrounded by, you know, full of land, how can you possibly run out of flour? How can you possibly run out of pigs and pork and meat and milk and cows? It's hard to fathom. Long story short, I was walking every month with my grandpa to a specific building in town, and each town had its own little office. And we would pick up those ration carts, a little stack of them for the family, and then they would be used to purchase things throughout the month. But grandpa was a very cheerful guy, and you know, he lived through World War II, and he felt like if there's no war, then things are good. And he would tell me stories about knights and castles and almost fairy tale, although now I realize some of them were real kings and real princesses. And so he was teaching me history. And the building itself was in a historic building that was connected somehow to the castle in town and separated by a church and a cemetery. And for me, it was a fairyland, you know, all those stories. So I have very fond memories of such a peculiar experience, because as a student of, you know, economics or in economic history, you would say, wow, this is horrendous. And to me, it was, no, I was having a great time with grandpa. Now, looking back at it, I realize this was such a bizarre experience. We could have gone on that walk for any other reason, but it adds, you know, a certain nuance and understanding to what was going on. I have to add and make a disclaimer here that there was a massive gray market functioning in Poland, so you could go and buy products directly from the farmers. The government decided and realized that they're so bad at running the economy that they have to let a tiny little free market function, because you can't suffocate people too much. They'll come out to the streets, which they did a couple of times in 1956, 68, 70, 80. They came out to the streets and they said, this is enough. So they were afraid that if they push it too hard, they'll come out. And they eventually did. And Poland freed up and Berlin Wall fell and we had free elections. So you could only push that hard. But when you think about the period between 1945 until 1990, that's 45 years of a very dark, oppressive system that people had lives under and, you know, tolerated it. As a kid, you don't have anything to compare it with. So as a kid, you are not the judge of your situation. You say, oh, I know that Matt in Pennsylvania has nicer toys than I do. I had no idea what Matt had in Pennsylvania. I still don't know. I'm guessing you had some cool toys there.
Kielbasa action figures, you might.
But you don't compare yourself with anything. You feel like this is the whole world. So I had a very happy childhood, but in a very strange time that made me ask and stay with a lot of big questions about how this whole thing works and how can I find my place in this world. And investing and the kind of investing that I do was something that really resonated with me, and I've enjoyed it ever since.
It strikes me that there's some connection between the ration card and what Buffett and Munger would call like the punch card investing. have you ever related those two things?
You have to choose carefully your investments. I think that's what you're referring to. Yes. I mean, you and I talked about constraints in life, how constraints actually create something positive at the end, right? If you limit yourself to a certain number of words, for example, probably the quality of the article you're about to post will go up because you really have to think about the words you're going to use and so on. So I think constraint can be helpful. And in a portfolio setting, when you think of investments, which I think about day in and day out, I could own every single stock that's out there. But what if I choose to own certain stocks? What are the things I want to look at and how am I going to manage this kind of a constraint? Everything is a constraint. In that sense, even your time horizon becomes a constraint. If you tell me I need this money back in 3 months, or you come back and say, this is the money for my kids and grandkids, it's a completely different investment conversation that you and I know that will lead to a very different decision, right? So what kind of constraint are you working with and what kind of results it can produce? But yeah, the ration card was a very real, but a made up constraint. By the way, you know, Poland took off in 1990 economically speaking. And it's very hard to measure because the currency meant nothing before 1990. That was just a made up exchange with the world. But in terms of number of cars, I don't remember. It was a massive increase of, you know, cars, for better or worse, but that's what happened. And Poland reclaimed its place as a massive pork producer, grain producer, and so on, the way it's been for most of history. That's why Russia, Germany, Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Sweden at times stopped by to restock. Right? So to think of Poland in 1985 saying, hey, we're out of flour. There's this joke that I told you, and you know, if you said it at the wrong time in Poland, you would be in jail. But that if they started communism in the Sahara Desert, they would run out of sand. And it's so true. Venezuela, country that's experimenting now with communist ideas, basically taking ownership away from people, has one of the richest oil reserves in the country, in the world. And they are experiencing shortages of gasoline at gas stations. They can't restart those refineries under the government rule. It's just not working. It's failing as an economy. And I actually happen to know quite a few people that left the country and tell stories. They rhyme with the experience I had. They're different. But just to say that certain arrangements in terms of the economic system have huge consequences on everyday, you know, people's life. And free market economy, I think, at the end of the day, wins. And I had some people argue with me about that, but I'll leave it out.
Well, this experience then, so you grow up in this fishbowl of a country, and it sounds like you had enormously valuable experiences with family and with other people. What's it like? What's the memory of your eyes get opened? You get exposed, all of a sudden there's this world outside of this border. You've told the story, you don't have to retell this now, but like, what's it like emerging from this and all of a sudden your eyes are open to the world around you?
It's that realization that the world is much bigger than I thought. And as a kid, you know, your world is the block you grow up on. So, and the next block is bigger than then, and it's all new. But for me, it was travel, and I mentioned it to you, and we spoke about it, how my parents decided to spend the little savings that they had to take me on a trip to Greece when I was 10 years old. It was the first moment you could really freely travel. And seeing Czechoslovakia still at the time, Hungary, and a big lake in Hungary, and then going down the coast of Croatia all the way to Greece. Around Albania, Albania was not friendly and not open at the time, but around Albania into Greece and seeing a very different world, colorful, more alive. And it made me realize that there are different arrangements of the universe out there. But the trip right before that one was a trip to Vienna. And it was the first time that I walked into a Western looking supermarket. Two floors, and they had salespeople, vendors in the middle showcasing some different, you know, kitchen appliances and slicers and dicers, and they had piles of tropical fruit. And I thought, wow, this is not far from physically, you know, geographically speaking, from where I live. But somehow here, something different happened. And it's such a lasting impression on a kid that something has worked here. These people are motivated. They have the incentives to show up and sell things. They have, something is working here. And that was my big incentive to understand how the economy works and how in one place it doesn't and in the other place it does. Poland today is a completely different, unrecognizable country. It's just like any other European country with, you know, everything else that you can think of that's available. And it's just, I can't even reconcile, you know, like in accounting, you try to reconcile things. And here I can't reconcile the image that I have of the 80s. And even I have the image of very, very fading image of the airport in Warsaw from the old era, which was like a metal little bunker thing and tiny little operation. Now there's this massive modern airport with beautiful, you know, hotels with big brands. And I'm thinking, could they have just left that old thing next to it as a museum to remind some of us that forgot what it was like. And it's all gone. I wish it was still there. You know, just the tapes off and take kids and show them. This was 1989, Warsaw Airport. This is the airport today. Do you think free market economy works? That's it.
Is the discovering of the Peter Lynch book, is this your first awareness? So you're a kid, you see the world all of a sudden, you get to travel, you get to open your eyes to the world. Is that your first awareness of owning stocks, of owning pieces of business, of not just the world allows for this thing, but now there's a way for you to participate?
So the stock market reopened in Poland. It shut down in 1939 when the Nazi tanks arrived, and it reopened in 1990, 91. It was a tiny stock market, and it had big parallels to the 1800s stock market in the US, with, you know, very few stocks and big bull markets and quick bear markets. And I'm sure there were a lot of things that you would call, you know, market manipulation and insider trading happening. I'm not going to make any claims here, but it sounded like it was a very inefficient, newly born market that had a lot to learn, figure out in terms of how this operation can work. And the smaller the market is, the harder it is to execute. So I didn't see the stock market as something that I was interested in. I remember as a kid, as a game, I would take the tickers from the newspaper, and I think there were 9 or 10 stocks. The major banks, one insurance company, you can imagine, a handful of companies. And I would write down the prices in my little notepad. And then next week I would check the prices, and I was mesmerized that they're moving. I had no idea why and what's the context. And so I had some curiosity, but because the market was going through such an upheaval at the time, I didn't see it as a place to keep money or get you know, long-term successfully rich. I saw it as a casino. And actually, my experience overlapped with the internet bubble bursting. So a lot of the professors that I met at school, some of them, I think, personally lost money with some internet stocks. There was one particular professor that really hated on Amazon. I mean, did not like Amazon.
The original Amazon bear was your teacher.
Because Amazon, at the peak of the bubble, went from $104 to $4, or $108 to $8, something like that. It basically lost $100, meaning it lost 95% or 97% of its value. And Bezos wrote a shareholder letter that I read years later. The first word was, ouch. You know, that was real, real pain. So that professor really experienced it. So not only I saw the Polish stock market that didn't sound like a place where you want to be, apart from being a gambler, but then I had my professors tell me, this is not the place you should be looking at as a, you know, profession, destination, or even interest. This is a casino. So Peter Lynch took me back, or created this massive leap in my head where I realized you can look at it as a casino, but you can also look at it as a place where you get to buy pieces of businesses. And that completely changed the way I look at the market and how I thought about it since. The one big point I want to make, and that I really liked about what Peter Lynch wrote about, was that the market, and Buffett talks about it too, the market doesn't care, the stock itself, the share, doesn't care that you own it. And the stock market doesn't care if you're young, if you're old, what's your gender. And it's such a powerful revelation when you're young, especially, that the market will not care if you do your work. And I think the biggest appeal for me at the beginning was the intellectual pursuit of stock research, investment research, that I could sit down and I could figure it out. It's not that I would do it faster than anybody else or that I'm smarter than anybody else, but I could figure it out. And then I could be patient enough to see that whatever I came up with is right. And the market would not say, hey, you're too young. You're too young to speak up. You're too young. No, the market didn't care. The reason I bring it up, and it's such a powerful revelation. I had Guido Alfani on the show, and I think his episode will come out by the time you air this. And he's a professor out of Italy. You and I talked about his book. He studied the rich, the super rich throughout history. And there's a point that he makes that I really liked, because it's a topic of my very first investment article that I wrote 10 years ago about the role of women in keeping and growing family fortunes. So Guido Alfani writes how women had the chance to participate in business success or business ownership when the joint stock company appeared, much more than before. Owning successful businesses was a bit of a cliquey experience. You knew somebody and they let you in on a deal, or you didn't know somebody and you couldn't be part of a partnership. So it cuts both ways, right? The partners all put up the money. They're all responsible for the success or the loans of the business. And then the joint stock company limits your liability. There's a small book that I'm forgetting that talks about the miraculous invention of a joint stock company. It's a tiny little book, but it explains how that idea that you put up the money, you have limited responsibility, liability, and it's secondary who you are. And in his book, he makes a point that rhymes with what I was saying earlier, that women had a chance to participate in those investments, which means they had a chance to grow and compound wealth that they had. And he talks about the records from Florence, I believe, that shows how many women actually owned a lot of those early enterprises. And it changed the dynamic and it allowed wealth creation and keeping the wealth and across genders, which is something that we take maybe for granted today, but it's all very recent that women can participate in the successes of businesses or even own a credit card. That's all very recent. Somebody just posted not long ago, when was the time when women could, in their own name, hold a credit card? And it's not that long ago. I don't want to say the wrong time, but it's not. No,
but it's shockingly close in history.
Shockingly close to today.
Shockingly is the correct word. Yeah.
So imagine, and he tells the story of a particular family and a woman, I think 1400s, 1500s, that had to, for religious prosecution reasons, had to travel around Europe and move around. They was able to operate a business in that environment and, you know, participate in the success of that business in a context that's really not easy or favorable. All this to say, the stock market and the fact that the market doesn't care who you are, that cuts both ways, but it also creates this opportunity for anybody, almost anybody, to benefit from the ownership without knowing somebody, having an in, having some sort of a way to get access to the business opportunity. You can go out there and buy the shares of the company that you like today without anybody's permission. You can go and do it, right? How powerful this is. If you wanted to be a part of any deal, you know, in Portugal, sending ships around Africa to find the spice route, you had to know the guy. You had to be indoors. You had to have the right papers to be a part of it, right? And it wasn't that easy to navigate that. Nowadays, you can go and buy a stake, as small as it is, in any company you like and benefit from its success. And nobody will say you're too young, or you have the wrong name, or you're from the wrong country. It's not the case for most of us, and hopefully eventually for all of us.
It's remarkable to think about that as a transformation of, it sounds like to you is the ultimate kind of like free markets definition here, is yes. The ability that anyone can participate at a level where they have access and can participate.
Yeah.
Feels like an extra profound thing, and I'm not trying to make this an extra profound thing for, trust me, you can see the clicks. We're not doing it enough for the clicks. Do you understand that? Do you feel it more deeply just because you have perspective on what you grew up, the Poland you grew up in, versus seeing this as an opportunity? I feel like you see and feel this in a way that's different from my learned experience.
I think I do. And maybe you have to be deprived of something to realize how important it is to have it. A simple and very powerful concept of property rights, the fact that you own something, you have a paper that says that you own something and that it's respected, not respected just today or until the president changes or until the king dies or before the king dies, which was most of the human history where you were in favor with the king. And the king would honor. It happened again and again that this is your land. The king changed. And the next king would say, no, these are my hunting grounds. Your family has to pack up and leave. This was a very real concern for anybody that acquired wealth. And in Guido's book, he talks about a lot of people that would lend money to the wrong king at the wrong time and get in real trouble. And so that's the realization. I think it made me appreciate the invisible things I work with families that have had wealth for many generations. And in some cases, if you really look back, I think some of the families that I had experience working with might have had some substantial wealth when Beethoven was composing his music. So it's when you really look at it, it's like the initial capital might have been created a long, long time ago. And one way or the other, the ownership of that capital was obviously, you know, under, there were things that change, industries change and so on and on. But there's a line, a thread, a historical thread that continues. And not long ago, I was talking to somebody about oil royalties, and they have a document that shows, you know, 5-6 generations later, they still collect oil royalties that were actually not producing much for a long time, and now they are producing more. And in Poland, or in my part of the world where I grew up, this was unheard of to have a paper that says that you own something in 1875 and somehow here in 2024, you still own it. There's no such thing.
You couldn't even get the flour that the ration card said you were entitled to.
No, no. So, if anything, I had symbols and very physical, real stories of wealth being lost. And you know, time after time within my family, of, you know, they had some success and it was lost or taken away or confiscated and so on. But I remember a little box that somebody had in the family that had old money, old paper money. And some of it was Russian money, Russian meaning with czar on it. And these were big pieces of paper. Like they were much bigger. They wouldn't fit in your traditional wallet. And that money was worthless, right? It maybe it's a collectible. But the money represented something. And I think there was a story that one of those pieces that were collected by somebody in the family long after it lost any value, you could buy, you know, a village for that piece of money. So to think of, you know, paper money as a concept and how you can inflate away the purchasing power of money, that's one way of doing about it. But there was actual confiscation of wealth that happened in that part of the world where people were, you know, their ownership was taken away. There's this one little story in my family about a piece of land that was in a town, actually not that far from the tree that you brought up, that my great-grandfather from the other side of the family bought before World War II. So there was one little catch in communist Poland. If you had a paper that said that this land was yours from before the war, after 1990, the courts would still honor and say this was issued by legit courts or legit, you know, administration before 1939, so you could still own it. And that piece of land is still held by somebody in the family. So there's some sort of unique, exceptional ownership. Had he bought it, or you couldn't actually buy it, there was an ownership called a 100-year lease or something like that during communist Poland. So they wanted to make sure that you give it back. It comes back. So you don't keep it. But he had that paper, or whoever in the family had that paper. But so there's this actual, you know, legal continuation that lasted. It's coming up on almost 100 years. That's something that I, you know, cherish as somebody that has so much experience working with families that kept wealth over long periods of time.
I have to look and see if I can figure this out, but I'm having a moment remembering, this is from at least 15 years or sometime early in my part of this industry, I met somebody and they had a bunch of, and it was this big question. So this would have been like early 2000s probably, where they had a good amount of land in Poland that was somehow tied to something like multiple generations back. Uh-huh. And it was this whole like, not that they were trying to sell the property, but it was this big confusing ordeal on the property rights for this thing. And you just made it suddenly make sense in my brain why it was such a big to-do. It could have gone back truly multiple generations on. And it was like farmland or something, but it was a really big deal of proving this ownership out.
I don't know if I told you that story, but in the 90s, my family built a little summer home by a lake, tiny little thing that we would go on weekends. And we bought the land from a farmer, somebody that owned the land. And this was the land that was the least attractive. It was along the trees, so you could grow things there, but it was the weakest kind of land. So he was probably the poorest farmer in the village. But somehow, because it was closer to the lake, that part of the land became really valuable.
Oh, yeah. Waterfront property. Look out.
There you go. So people appreciate it for very different reasons than the actual farming.
Right.
So we bought it and we built the house and we're sitting there one weekend. And as a kid, I remember that this other farmer that we knew would see him, say hello, stop by and he says, "How are you enjoying my land?" A different farmer. And we say, "What do you mean?" "Well, so this was my dad's or my grandpa's." And we said, no, we bought it from the other guy.
Oh, no.
He says, well, the 1/3 is mine and the other 2/3 are his. And it led to a whole ordeal where we ended up paying twice for a piece of the land to another person. And we settled that. And from the other guy, we ended up buying a little bit more to plant a couple of fruit trees. But it was a lesson for me. Do you really own it? And I apply that question again and again and again. When you own a stock in the United States, there's a very deep and broad system that protects you. It's invisible. It's like breathing. You know, you don't know you have air. You need air until you climb a tall mountain and you realize, wow, there's no oxygen here. Property rights are like that. You don't think you need them. You think you can trust them until they get tested. And this was a moment where we realized that we didn't have all the paperwork or whatever that paperwork was not binding. And it was questioned and we had to pay it. There are some stocks listed in the US from different parts of the world. I mean, China is one of them, where they trade and they look the same as anything else, right? There are a couple of stocks. But when you actually look at the filings and you see how they're listed, and I'll leave it to people that want to commit time. And you're laughing, but you know what I'm talking about, that you actually don't own the underlying asset through those things. They're very elaborate offshore structures that make it look like you own the original Chinese company, but you don't. And people look at it and they say, well, I bought Coca-Cola and I bought the other thing. You bought it, sure, the same way we bought that land. Do you own it? That's a very different question. And in the United States and in big parts of Europe, people assume that if I bought it, then I own it. Try to travel around a little bit and ask questions and see how the world functions, how in so many places, it's very hard to prove that you actually own something, even if you paid for it. There is a book by, I think his name is Hernandez de Soto, an economist that wrote a book about property rights, a fascinating book. And he explains why some parts of the world.
Goes all the way back to like Magna Carta and everything else. Does that sound familiar?
Probably. He focuses on recent years or the recent decades when you see booming developing economies and you kind of have two worlds. One where the property rights are very observed and honored, and a vast part of the same countries where property rights are very hard to enforce. And he says that the path out of poverty is property rights. And I think it's a powerful revelation because once you know that you own something, you care for it. If it's a house on a block on the street, and then you take care of the lawn because you own it. If it's any type of communal ownership where there's no real owner, it kind of gets diluted and may have no consequences for a while, but eventually it does, that nobody cares for something that's allegedly everybody's. And having that power to actually own something, pass it on, be able to sell it. He also says, you know, mortgage it, take out a loan against that asset. It's a very powerful economic force that allows people to get out of property. And he talks about different experiments in different parts of the world where property rights were reinforced and people would actually feel that they're owners of a particular, even the smallest land. They could borrow money to buy equipment, to farm and increase their productivity and so on. All this to say property rights are a huge gift and a very important thing. And they were completely disregarded for 45 years in Poland. And I think knowing what it means to own something and to be able to own it over multiple generations, it's a huge gift. The only reason to get rich is to be able to stay rich to me. Like there's no reason to win a lottery today and be poor tomorrow. Like for me, it's a ridiculous idea, right? Like, hey, I won the lottery and the next day people show up and take it away. That's nonsense, right? So all you want, really, is to know that if you get rich, is it okay that I keep it? Which historically speaking is not that obvious. And even today, geographically speaking, it's not that obvious that if we notice that you have a bit more, you get to keep it, Matt. That's not that obvious.
And when you think about keeping it, you're not, and this is an important distinction in everything, the way that you explain these things. You're not talking about keeping it in a pure hoarding sense.
No.
And when you, in service to your clients, you're not talking about them building wealth for the sake of hoarding wealth. And I think I want to put the highlighter all over this one.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? Why is wealth, making it wealth as a tree, why is the purpose of this not to hoard? And then what is that purpose?
Well, that capital has many purposes, right? So even in the simplest form, if you want to start the smallest business and you want to start a fruit stand and you need some initial capital to go out and buy all the fruit to fill up the shelves, right? So that's your inventory. That's like the most basic sense of capital. If you have only $5 to your name, you have to go out and sell the second thing that you have, which is your time. Until then, you have to save, accumulate a little bit of that capital or borrow it. And then even you can't even open a fruit stand with a little bit of inventory, with a little bit of a capital, right? So the capital in the smallest, more, the most accessible, understandable way, it's that kind of element that allows you to function in a business way. On a human personal level, a lot of people live paycheck to paycheck or hand to mouth, the expression is. And it's staggering, not just in the US, but around even the developed world. And I'm not even thinking about the developing world, where in some situations, when you travel the world today, in some parts of the world that we say developing world, there are people that basically live through the day as a 24-hour cycle. They go out and they work, they collect a little bit of money, and that money pays for the food for the evening. The American way of going shopping for a whole week, it's a fairly unique model. I know it's being adopted in many places, and that's how people shop in Poland today too. But in many parts of the world, people shop for what they need today. When you research companies like Procter & Gamble or Colgate, consumer goods, you might be surprised that you go to different parts of the world and they don't have boxes that have 5 pounds of laundry detergent or whatever it is. They sell them in little packets that are used just for tonight. Why is that? Because the individual that's shopping only has money for tonight. They have the money for the piece of meat, the rice, the beans, and a laundry little packet for tonight. And that's how products are sold, because people think and operate and are able to function in a 24-hour cycle. If you want to break out from that cycle, you start to create capital. Your savings become capital that allows you to think about long-term, tomorrow, next week, maybe save for a refrigerator, maybe save for a TV, maybe save for a car. And you could call it different names, but at the end of the day, it's a human need to have more than last 24 hours. That's where the capital starts. And it grows all the way in scale to the point where you have enough of that capital to never work again for money, to never be in a position where you have to sell your time or skills for money. And it's that moment where the capital is able to provide as such enough of an income and appreciation and return for you to never work again. And I think it's very hard to embrace. And the financial independence movement brought this idea closer to a lot of people that with, everyday real, not very well paid even jobs, you could accumulate enough wealth to never work again. But working with wealthy individuals, they are sometimes born into that reality, that work in the sense that most of us see it as I have to go out there and earn a living. There are expressions that say, earn a living, earn enough to live. They don't have to. They have a very different predicament. Many different ways of looking at it, but the biggest worry for wealthy people is that they would like to keep it forever. And hence the infinite horizon that I talk about. I spoke with Ken Honda, who wrote Happy Money not long ago. And I think the episode will come out by the time you air this one. And he has this sentence. Well, he has many ideas in the book, and I highly recommend the episode, but he has this idea that I just mentioned, that when you really look at what's the challenge for very, very wealthy individuals, is that they would like this kind of wealth to last forever. And that's where you and I have an opportunity to help, because there are ways to perpetuate wealth and see this as capital you can't afford to risk. You can't afford to lose it, but it's a capital that you don't necessarily need. You don't need, you know, 50 years of your living expenses day to day. But that capital can be deployed in a very productive way, not in necessarily directly by you, but the businesses you own, they'll make use of that capital, and they'll provide things to fill up the shelves with products and services and all the things that people need. There's a huge benefit. You know, we went all the way from a fruit stand that's just making it possible for you to go and get a fresh apple or a banana in the evening, all the way to having a very complicated company that's present in 200 countries. For that company to exist, we need so many things to happen, all the way from property rights to a functioning, you know, liquid stock market, all the way to the capital that's available in the economy. Without that capital, we're going back to a 24-hour cycle where we just buy what we need by the sunset and we start over with nothing tomorrow.
How do you think about the wisdom, the aspect of, I feel like there's a line, and it's a very strong line between, if you're raised in a communist country, if you're raised in a 24-hour purchase cycle family, or if you're starting there, or if you're starting where you never think about any of that stuff and you don't even know this exists, how does that thinking get passed forward? Like, when you're working with a wealthy family who's inherited, you're on G2 or G3 of this money, is it on your shoulders? Whose shoulders is it on to help them see the rest of the world and understand the context that this all fits together?
Well, I noticed that families have a way of including children relatively early in the process and in the communication. It's not that they have to know everything, but I think certain awareness helps. And I think awareness is a big word. And allowing them to have a variety of experiences. The book that I mentioned, The Inheritance Experience, you know, brings up how once your life is very siloed, whether it was my life in Poland or somebody growing up with very affluent circumstances, then you have very limited range of scenarios, a range of outcomes in your mind. What I noticed with a lot of the people I worked with was that at some point of their life, they decided to just pack up and leave. And they went on different missions or travel or do things. And those trips to a completely different part of the world and seeing how people live in a completely different way with very different concerns expands the way you see the world. That when you look back at your own circumstances, you can see them differently. There's a writer that I like a lot, Pico Iyer, that you might know. And he writes about travel, but he's more of a philosopher. And he says that you have to leave the place where you were born or where you live to get to know yourself better. I'm paraphrasing, but I thought it's such a big idea that, what do you mean that to get to know myself, I have to leave where I am? But there's so much truth to it, because for you to see where you even are today, you have to leave to see that place from a different perspective. And no matter what the circumstances are, right? Whether you're expanding and you're realizing the world is bigger, or you realize, I have a very comfortable, affluent life. Not everybody does. What does that mean? And I think that chance to go and see the world, I think it's the biggest blessing. And whether the family invites that or the kids want to do it, but I think it's the biggest thing that can really open their eyes and make them realize this is a very special, exceptional arrangement that I was born into. I have those stories in my family where different members of the family were in very comfortable circumstances that didn't last multiple generations. So I have all those stories of, you know, money
inside
made, money lost.
Inside my own family.
Inside my own family. And that's why I had this very important lesson in my head that if I get to acquire wealth in this lifetime. It's not just about the acquisition, but what is it that I can do to keep it even throughout my lifetime, which is already not a given. It's something that's it's not that easy to accomplish. There are a lot of people that have that lucky streak at some point and they're making a lot of money and it doesn't translate to the later age. I'm thinking of athletes especially. You know, that's a kind of an extreme example where they make a lot of money between, you know, 20, 25 and then they can't perform. And they have to figure out how to make it last. But that's an extreme example. I know, you know, business people that have 5 or 10 years that are really, really good and they think that will last and it doesn't. So when you think of a lifelong pursuit, investing and building your wealth and keeping your fortune, that's already a huge ask. And when you think of a infinite, open-ended, kind of a blue horizon ahead of you mindset and thinking, I don't want just this generation to do very well, but I'd like the next generation in the family, whether it's your immediate kids or nieces and nephews or cousins, I would like them to have equally comfortable circumstances that I do. I think it's more of an exception than a rule, especially if you think about multiple generations accomplishing it. When you think about this very wealthy families, in terms of history and in terms of statistics even, how much of an exception to the rule it is, rather than something that obviously happens. There's so much that can happen that will derail that process from outside and inside. So the fact that, you know, 5 generations later, there's still something in terms of financial capital for us to sit down and talk about. Let's pause for a second and say, wow, right? What a miracle it is that there's something for us to even talk about today.
What a miracle, and what I'm really drawn, and I know you value this because I know, you know, you, your wife, your nieces, nephews, extended family, you very conscientiously think about trying to build this wealth for yourself and mm-hmm. trying to help clients preserve it and pass it on in this context. That community, those people that are around and impacted by this thing, that speaks volumes to you. And I can tell you live it in your through your clients. You help your clients live it in their lives. You live it throughout your own life in making sure that that awareness is always there. Do you feel like in your own life, like what are you doing personally to help enforce that awareness around you? What are the stories you tell to the nieces, nephews, extended family members about why you're making the choices? Like you launched your own business not long ago. You're living in interesting places. You're not just holed up in a New York City apartment anymore. No. How do you tell others about those stories that you care the most about?
I think teaching is a fascinating pursuit because there are many ways to go about it. And I find from the experience I've had and the families that I have a lot of respect for that I work with is that you probably teach more through actions, you know. Others watch what you do. And I can talk and say what I think works for me, but it only goes that far. I have parents that talk to me and they say, you know, my kids don't want to listen to what I have to say. And some topics have to be introduced in a more nuanced way, you know, through a book or a discussion or a conversation, maybe with somebody, even from outside of the family. And so what I try to do is maybe set an example that makes sense for me and others can watch and see if it makes sense for them. And I hear those little stories from my different cousins that they say, oh, they did something because it's something I would do. And I take this as a compliment. And maybe that's better than me telling them what to do because I don't know. I think life is such a personal, individual experience that I can't tell you how to live your life. But I can show you what I did and why it worked for me. And when I think of the money experience, it's all the way from, you know, monthly budgeting and realizing that you're spending less than you make, right? The most basic idea, all the way to having capital work for you. I think of it as multiple escape velocities, kind of like a rocket leaving the planet into space. Megan and I were on a walk, I think about a year ago now, and it was an evening and it was a beautiful night, and we see this object in the sky and we had no idea what it is. It looked like first it looked like a star, but then it changed the shape. And I honestly thought that this might be the moment when I'm seeing a UFO for the first time in my life. And we stopped and we looked at it and I thought, oh, how am I going to explain? How am I going to tell anybody that I actually saw something like that? A couple of minutes later, we realized we're looking at the SpaceX launch that was going into the sky and launching some satellites. So it was not a UFO. But anyways, it made me think of, in physics, there's the concept of an escape velocity, that the rocket has to reach a certain speed to leave the orbit or reach the orbit and then travel around the Earth. And I was thinking, when you think of money, and there are some big parallels between physics and money. Before I got fascinated with investing, I actually loved physics because it gave me some comfort and understanding of things. But the closer you look at physics, the more you realize how nuanced it is and things are not exactly the way classical Newtonian physics explain. It's much more complicated and we don't actually know a lot of things. It's kind of like with money. You think you have the principles figured out, but the closer you look, you realize this is much more nuanced and all those things are in motion and they change. But anyways, the first escape velocity would be the one where you spend less than you make.
Right.
You start to accumulate that capital that you brought up. That's the first moment, right?
Yeah.
then you reach that point. And then you can travel all the way to the point where work becomes optional. And it's such a fascinating concept where you have enough saved, just to make it very simple and, you know, formulaic for a second. But if you have that many years saved, and I think the many people have even 6 months saved in expenses, the decisions they make, the choices they make become different. If you don't like this boss, you're going to change a job because you have 6 months of savings left. Otherwise, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, you're going to say yes to whatever they tell you to do, right? That's a massive, massive. It's freedom, it's choice, it's power, it's control, you name it, there are many words for it. But if you have 20 or 25 years of expenses saved, work really becomes optional. Megan and I used to go on those long walks around the big pond in Central Park, and now and then I would ask her, how would you live your life if money was not an issue? It's not that you can go out there and, you know, splurge on everything, but just you don't have to think about it. The rent is paid or the mortgage is paid, everything is paid. And the reason to go to work is not to earn a living. You go to work or you do something because you really have to do it. And it really invites a whole different discussion. That's how I feel about the work I do. I really have to do it. I'm absolutely fascinated with the pursuit in front of me, all the way from investing to understanding the family dynamics and the whole nuanced way of what that money means to them. I have to do it. It's my calling in this lifetime. And I have this broad understanding of, ever-growing understanding of how it all works. I have to do it. It's been a long time that I was doing it just to earn a paycheck. That's not the goal. And it's a bigger topic and you get me started on those things. But when you think about who do you want in your life, you know, your doctor, your accountant, your money manager and on and on. Do you want somebody, let's say you need a knee surgery. Do you go to a doctor that's doing it just for the money? I mean, it pays so well to do that knee surgery and he has no heart in it, no care, no interest. He doesn't even remember your name. Just get on the table. We'll get the knee done. Or you want to go to a doctor that this was his or her calling. She had to do it. She had to become a knee surgeon. And you meet people like that in all kinds of fields. They had to do it. This is all they wanted to do. They wake up and they fall asleep thinking about it. They go to conferences to learn more about the new techniques. They go to events to learn about the different new technology around it. They just have to be on top of it and at the edge of the seat all the time. And yes, there's money that follows, but it's not the number one thing. And the last piece of it is that they actually care. They'll sit down with you. They'll hold your hand. You're going to say, Matt, we've done all the talking. I've done my work. We have the lab results. You need a knee surgery. And this is the doctor. I'm the doctor that's going to do it. You want that person to hold your hand. And that's the kind of work that you and I do. We sit down with people and say, I devoted my life to doing this, and there's nothing else I would rather do. And I care about you. and about your life and about your family. And I want to make sure that we do the best thing we can. This is this idea that I talked about with Christian Billinger on the show, pride in what you do, soul in the game. You want to have people in your life that will do the right thing, even if nobody is watching. I think it's such a powerful revelation when you really, really think about it. You want an accountant, a lawyer, a doctor, everybody in your life to do the right thing. Even a plumber that shows up to fix your sink. You want them to do the right thing, even if nobody's watching. And if you have no idea how to fix that sink, you want them to do it the best way possible because they are so proud in how good the work they delivered is. If you can surround yourself with people like that, that's a really nice life.
Bogomil, this has been so special. I got notes. I want to try to summarize some of this conversation. But in the interest of surrounding yourself with people, I think that right, what you said there, right there, just embodies everything that you're talking about this through these people over time, through these seasons. Yeah, you talked about wealth as a tree, seeing stocks as the small pieces of businesses. We talked about the ration cards and relating them to punch card investing, which is, that's a mind bender. People talking like markets as casinos, but then Peter Lynch flipping your thinking. And I couldn't help but imagine this as buying pieces of, not just buying pieces of companies, but from your background, owning a piece of something as like owning a piece of something of safety and not acting then as just, did you buy it? It doesn't stop with, did you buy it? It stops with, do you own it? And if you own it, then you have to take care of it. We talked about planting trees for others to enjoy and how that can be made to make stuff, books, podcasts. Trees are a bridge to a future generation. Trees are a bridge to, you know, Bogomil's blog and YouTube and books and everything else. The assumptions of experience of what's same versus different, the constraints, you growing up in a communist country and seeing the constraints come off, how that perspective constraint shifts and it adds value, it adds perspective. And when you do that over and over, I loved how you related that back to athletes, indirectly, sort of directly to star fund managers, the people who don't just shut it down, who have a lifelong pursuit, have a blue horizon, have a blue infinite horizon, perhaps, to quote your company name a little bit in there. Something our mutual friend Ben Hunt talks about all the time, the invoking the water in which we swim, narrative reality. Knowing when you're a fish in a fishbowl, knowing when you're a fish in the ocean, and being in a fishbowl, knowing the ocean exists, or knowing you're in the ocean, but the fishbowl exists too. Very like Finding Nemo type thing about that. When you're blocked out of investing, and then suddenly you're able to, the story of women and joint stock ownership, it's this idea of community around these things. True investment doesn't just happen anonymously on a marketplace. True investment happens with the sense of community, where it's respected, where it's honored in the form of property rights, and it's enforced in terms of free markets, which is just profoundly beautiful to me. The belief that you can participate in this communal investment, in wealth creation, and really in education. I love that you talked about including the kids and including the grandparents, because the wisdom is always communal.
It is.
Just like wealth. You made me think of, and I'm going to depart from the notes on what you said and just something else I wrote down for myself. When you started talking about escape velocity, I started to think about, and I don't know if you know this song. There's a song, it's called My Flying Saucer. Billy Bragg performed it. Are you at all?
Well, sing it for us.
And they're resisting it for you right now. But when you're talking about escape velocity, you made me think of this song. And so Woody Guthrie, the famous folk artist, when he passed away, they found all these notebooks of lyrics, of poetry. And in collaboration with the family, who said, these are all songs that dad never recorded, or it never made it onto something that anybody knows about or whatever. It's kind of early recorded music for the most part anyway. And so Jeff Tweedy of, you know, Wilco, Uncle Tupelo fame, Billy Bragg of famous English punk rock and skiffle and all the things. He's done fame. They got access. They got permission to use these books and write these songs about it. Mm-hmm. And there's an incredibly beautiful song. I'll encourage you to go check out. Listeners, go check this out too. It's called My Flying Saucer. And it's a beautiful, kind of silly, kind of childish, but kind of perfect poem about seeing a flying saucer and a wish not upon a star, but upon this foreign body. And again, it's one of those things. He wrote these lyrics. These lyrics passed on to another generation who recreated a whole thing of music and these Mermaid Avenue projects 20 years ago now and recycled them out. So escape velocity side note. But back to you. Wealth as a tree. And I'm just going to say that again and again and again. Wealth is a tree that we plant, that we can enjoy, that others later can enjoy and foster that. But it's a living thing. And until it's something useful or not anymore. You can plant it, you can grow it, you can write a book about it. A book is a seed. A blog post is a seed. One of these videos can be a seed. The point is that we plant a new one, that we invest, and we do it with purpose. We do it as we invest in people. We invest for people. We invest with people. And we teach through our actions. I'm going to get WWBBD bracelets made for what would Bogomil Baranowski do? That's the thing here. It's about the actions. It's about no matter what, who you're guiding, who you're advising, who you're teaching, who you're doing this for, about doing with the actions. You, Bogomil Baranowski, my dear friend, you are truly an intentional investor. Thank you so much for your time today.
Wow, this was incredible. And I love how you closed it, that it's all about people. It's a people's business. Whose money are you managing? What are their lives like? And I love that. Let's not forget that they're people. And they have their worries, concerns, and needs. And that's what we're here for. Matt, thank you so much. This was incredible.
Thank you, Bogomil.
Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe wherever you're watching The Intentional Investor so more people can find our show. You can follow Matt directly at cultishcreative.com or at cultishcreative on Twitter. For more great content at the intersection of investing and life, check out EpsilonTheory.com or at EpsilonTheory on Twitter.